This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Studio Secrets A to Z, and I'm your host, Anthony J. Resta, and I'm really excited to introduce our next guest. We have a very long, involved tale to tell. This is Carl Napa, producer, musician, engineer extraordinaire, mixer, just a marvelous dear friend. Welcome, Carl.
Thanks, Anthony. It's really, really good to be here.
It's crazy, man. We have quite a history,
Yeah. And
we're gonna get into it. So let's start at the beginning. Why not? I mean, for us, and then we'll go back even further in your life after that. But Carl and I started working together, I think, in the early 90s, we'll just say, right? And we were working at Cortland Recording in Hanson, Mass.
Before that, we met at a Performance Music Center, remember?
Oh, and that's right. Yep. Joe's incredible store.
Yeah, Joe Mullins had you teaching there as a drum instructor, and I was teaching there as a guitar instructor.
That's where we met.
That's where we met.
Wow, that's even further back than I remembered. That's crazy. So I started inviting you to come, assist on some sessions with Bob and I. Is that how it began?
Yeah, you asked me one day, aren't you going to ULOL for engineering? And I said, yeah, that's where I'm going. And it was in the beginning part of it, so it was first couple years over there was all core courses, so I really wasn't doing any recording. And you had mentioned that you were working with Bob down in Cortland, and you just needed someone to, wrap cables or just, run errands and stuff like that. So you started inviting me down, and I'd come down and sit in the back of the room and wouldn't really say anything and just, kind of observe.
Wow.
And, it started to get more and more frequent.
Yeah. I mean, you had that rare studio gene that when you have it, it's just, you just have it. It's just you just want to live it.
Yeah.
And we ended up camping out there for months.
A lot of months. Yeah. Me and you, well, it was funny because, obviously, you and Bob had a big history, right, before
yep.
I was even involved. You guys had done a lot of things together. And at the time, you had another partner named Paul.
Yep.
Savoni, right?
Yep.
And, I was just this young kid who didn't really know anything, and I wanted to make an impression. And I don't know if you know this story or not, but there was a supermarket on the way to the studio.
Yep.
And I used to stop by there in the morning, and I'd go to the bakery. And I'd take a bag, it was the honor system kind of, you tell the person what you bought, and I'd fill this bag with donuts and Danish, and it would be falling out of the bag, and I'd walk up to the line, I'd look for the youngest, cutest little girl behind the counter, and she'd be like, well, what's in the bag? And I'd be like, two donuts? And it'd be like, okay, 50 cents, and I'd bring it to the studio, and I'd lay it out on a plate and make fresh coffee. And I remember you guys walking in you bought donuts? I'm like, don't worry about it. I got it. I was fucking stealing those donuts every morning. and I just enjoyed going there. And I just, I knew nothing. I remember Bob saying, go put an 87 on such and such. And I'd run out there and they kept all the mics on that ledge, remember?
Yep. Great mic collection.
And I was just I don't know what an 87 is. And I'd have to look through them all. And then I'd probably put the wrong one up and Bob would yell at me. And it was just funny, Fred had a beautiful studio. and him and Pat were always so generous to me. Like, they let me stay there with you a lot. And then sometimes when you'd go home, I would stay there.
Yep.
They'd let me use the house in the morning to clean up. I'd try to do it before anybody wake up. And it was just, it was a very special time.
Yeah, we had the best time. It was, we would go to JJ's pub every night and have a few $1 drafts.
We definitely had a system, didn't we?
Yeah.
And the moment Bob finished and you finished, we ran the JJ's.
Yeah.
And then, do you remember where we went after that?
No.
Chinese.
Oh, that's right.
We'd go and get, because they were open till a little bit later, and we'd have a couple of Mai Tais. And I don't even remember where the Chinese place was.
Then we'd go back to the studio and jam.
Jam all night long.
Yeah.
I'd play bass and you'd play drums, and play. I was learning how to use my thumb back then.
And we would write like really weird songs, like Talking to the Penguin.
Yep. Trashed at the Cape.
Match, I wish we had recordings of some of that stuff. But Carl, you just really, you know, had that gene, and you learned everything and ended up taking all that information after working on Extreme Records with Bob. And tell us how that parlayed into you getting a job at the Hit Factory.
So Bob took me under his wing, and for about 2.5 years, I did everything with him.
Yep.
The first big thing we did outside of all the stuff you guys were doing and the things at Cortland was Three Sides to Every Story.
Legendary album.
Down at New River Studios. Remember that? Down in Fort Lauderdale? And I knew nothing. I mean, I thought I was going down there as Bob's assistant, knew everything. And the assistant down there, who was really an engineer, Jim Thomas, just schooled me. And I realized how far I was really behind.
Wow.
You know, I knew a lot, but I never had a chance to work in a studio. Like, I worked for an engineer who worked for a studio.
Right.
Jim worked in a studio. And so the downtime, you know, he learned a lot. And also just doing sessions. So he taught me how to do recall. He taught me how to, you know, I observed him and just watching him run a session as an assistant, you know what I mean? And it really, it brought my game up, you know, to an exponential level. So that when, you know, we'd go after that, you know, I remember when we did the Extreme 4, I think I showed up before Bob at Criteria, and I walk in and they were like, well, who the fuck are you? Can I swear in this podcast?
Yeah, oh yeah, you can.
And I'm Bob's assistant, Carl, and I want this here, I want this here, we're going to do this. And I had set up Bob's sessions so many times. Like, I knew what Bob wanted before Bob knew what Bob wanted, right?
Yeah.
Because I knew how he did it, right?
Yeah.
But I never sat in the chair,
yeah.
Right? When it came time to get the sounds, Bob sat down and did his magic. And it is magic. I mean, anybody who's been around Bob, they know his ears hear different than a lot of us. So when I got to New York, and I'll tell you how that happened, but I had never sat in a chair, and it was terrifying. And so I spent a lot of time woodshedding those first year or so in New York, just getting my chops up as an engineer so that when I got called to do sessions, and it was pretty quickly once I got there, I was ready.
That's amazing.
But how I got there is a crazy story. Do you have time for that?
Yes, that's why we're here.
We did Extreme 4 down in Criteria, which was a lot of months.
Yeah.
And those records were fun to make because you were there a lot, and you know how it was. But if anybody who doesn't, we would just move down to Florida and we'd all stay in the same condo complex. And every day, we'd drive to the studio together. We'd go to the gym first, then we'd go to the studio, and then we'd come back and rinse and repeat, you know, 6 days a week.
It's right? Like Groundhog Day, really.
Yeah. The first day we got down there, we had hired a runner who was going to drive us back and forth. And good old Brian didn't really work out as a driver. He was a very good driver.
Yeah.
I mean, really good driver. but we wanted someone a little more lead-footed.
Yeah.
So I kind of took over that role. And I would get us from Fort Lauderdale to Miami pretty quickly in the morning. Surprised we never got a ticket. Anyways, we did that record. Then we moved to New York and we did Nono's solo record. That's where Schizophonic started.
And that's where I was worked on that. I was co-producing.
And I don't remember the name of the studio, do you?
Clinton.
Clinton Studios, that's right. They had the two 8078s, right?
Yeah, beautiful studio.
And we were in studio, I believe, A downstairs.
Yeah.
And that was a month or two. I don't remember how long. But at the time I was married and my wife Annie was from the New Jersey area.
Yeah.
And so she would come down there and visit us and She would be afraid to get out of the car because that's when Hell's Kitchen was kind of rough back then.
Yeah.
And one night, early on in the record, we were walking somewhere, went to a club or something to see a band.
Yeah.
We weren't getting a drink. We weren't just out drinking. We were going to see some music. And I remember we were in the Upper West Side somewhere, and we get to the stop sign or light. And I look over at Nuno, and I go, I think I'm going to stay in New York when this record's done. He's like, yeah, that's great. Like, you know, we got about a week off before we start the next thing. And I don't remember what the next thing was.
Yeah.
And he goes, but yeah, why not? I go, no, you're missing my point. Like, I'm going to stay in New York. What do you mean stay in New York? How are you going to get back and forth to work? Like, that's 3 hours, 3.5 hours each way. I go, yeah, you're still missing my point. Like, I'm going to move. I'm going to quit Bob and kind of, I want to go on my own. Like,
yep.
I've been an assistant long enough. And he looked at me kind of funny and, you know, he'd probably speak better on that than me, but I felt like he thought that we're all going to get old and he'd be the producer and Bob would be the engineer and I'd be the assistant. We'd be like the age I am right now.
Yeah.
Still doing the same roles. And it felt like 2 or 3 days where he didn't even talk to me. And like, we used to go to the gym every morning. We used to work every day. Like, and I was getting like the cold shoulder and I think, you know,
it was hard. Yeah.
Cause I hadn't told Bob yet. Right.
Yeah.
And, I walk into work one morning because I was staying at a different place than him and Bob. They were in like some real fancy hotel, and I was staying on with the manager, the day manager. What was his name? Bernstein.
Oh yeah,
you remember Scott?
Yeah.
I was staying in Scott's apartment, so I was slumming it on the Upper West Side, and those guys were in like mansions. But anyways, I'm not bitter. I was just an assistant. No, but actually, I had great accommodations. He walked up to me and he goes, you have an appointment tomorrow at the Hit Factory at 10 a.m. Our session starts at 11. Don't be late. I go, what? He goes, I called Troy, the owner. You have an appointment to meet with him at 10 o'clock in the morning. Our session starts at 11. Don't be late.
So he hooked you up with that?
And you know what I said? I said, no, man, I don't want that. I want to send my resume out. I want to see if I can get a job. Like, I was just stupid, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, shut the fuck up. Go to your appointment. And I did.
Yeah.
And when I got there, I had a great interview with Troy. And at one point, like, he's grilling me on things that I knew and didn't know. Do you know the SSL? Do you know the Neve? Do you know this? Do you know that? And because, you know, I'd worked with Bob so long at such a high level, like, I knew all that stuff, right?
You were ready.
And he was like, well, what do you want from me? I'm like, I want a job. And he hired me. And I said, I can't start until I finish this record because it's not cool that if just to jump ship. And he goes, well, when do you finish? I'm like, May, whatever. And he looked at a calendar. That was a Friday. He goes, Monday, you start here. And I did.
Wow.
And,
amazing.
It was pretty amazing.
It's crazy. And like, let's talk about some of the sessions you did at the Hit Factory. I mean, that could take up two podcasts in itself. But you were telling my kids tonight, you came to our house and we had dinner and the kids are into hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, who did you work with? And he's like, Carl's like, Snoop, Biggie Smalls.
Go, you know,
I mean, there's a lot. I mean,
Wu-Tang.
I mean, that's incredible. I mean, what was all that? Those.
So,
tell us about that.
What's interesting is when I got to New York, probably around 94-ish, somewhere around there, right? I had just done 3 years, 2.5 to 3 years with Bob doing heavy metal.
Yeah.
Like we did hard rock.
Yeah.
We might have done a jazz record along the way. You know, I could probably count them on one hand, right?
Yeah.
When I get to New York, all those engineers and assistants, all they wanted to do was rock and roll. And they were doing what was becoming the new pop music was hip hop was starting to come to fruition, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't want to do this shit no more. Like, I just did 10 million records, you know what I mean? Where heavy guitar, right? We get a guitar sound. We do the backgrounds, you know, It wasn't a formula, but it was a way of making records, right? And drums and stuff. And all of a sudden, I got a chance to set up a drum machine and a keyboard and use an SPX-80 and sync everything up through MIDI timecode.
Yeah.
Had no idea what I was doing, but I wanted to do that.
Yeah.
And I jumped in head first and I took everything that came my way. And at that time, Puffy was just starting Bad Boy Records.
I remember being there working on Nuno's record and seeing his name like
on everything.
But he was Puffy Combs.
Yep.
He wasn't
Sean Puffy Combs. Yeah. Because that was before there was even an office, you know, and there was at least three or four studios every night. And we worked with on everything there. And through that, I met a guy named Vincent Herbert, and his engineer was Ben Garrison, and they took me under their wing, and I assisted them a lot. To the point where Ben was so busy, Vincent looked at me one day and was like, hey, can you engineer this session? And I was like, yeah, of course I can. And the next day I got a call from Hit Factory, the daughter, Danielle, she booked all the studios. And she was like, well, we want to manage you. If you're going to do this thing, we're going to manage you. I'm like, cool. I don't even know what that means. But and then literally I just started engineering. Yeah. I went from, you know, making $7.50 as an assistant engineer to $75 as an engineer.
Yeah.
Like overnight. Yeah. And I thought I was rich.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What a great...
I could afford dinner now and I could like pay rent on time. But that started the next chapter of my life of you know, heavy duty engineering sessions. And in those days, pre-Pro Tools, way before Pro Tools, still had analog desks and machines and you had to go to a recording studio.
Yeah.
And we got a chance to... I get a chance to work on, you name, like a who's who of superstars, right?
Yeah.
Because the Hit Factory was that place that was super expensive and prestigious.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was we finished people's records. Like when, if something was wrong, they'd come there. Or if a record got rejected, they'd have to do two more songs, they would come to the Hit Factory and finish it, right? Because it was in New York, they could watch their clients. And so a lot of that early records never got any credit for it. I probably have more credits that I don't have on people's records than most people have on records, right?
Yeah.
Because the records were done, the artwork was in, they were just filling out two more songs. And, you know, I don't know how many times I heard, oh, we'll get you on the reprint. Don't worry about it.
Oh, yeah.
Great. Yeah, because you'd go to the store back then and buy the record because you were so excited to see your name and that you participated. And it wouldn't be there.
Yeah, that's hard. Yeah. That's happened to me multiple times, too.
Yeah, it stings a little, but after a while, we're like, whatever.
It happens. It happens. Peter Wolf told me that the artwork got cut off at the bottom. That was my favorite excuse. fun stuff.
Yeah.
So those sessions were, I mean, I remember working on stuff there while you were working on other stuff, and I remember, like, Michael Jackson bought lunch for everybody in the building for like over a year. Tell us about that.
Yeah, not on purpose, but yeah. When I got down there, they had just started the History record.
Yeah.
And Michael took studio 4 and 5 in the new building. There was two buildings, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There was one between 8th and Broadway and one between 9th and 10th.
Yeah, the shiny fancy one, yep. And the old one. Which
and the old one.
That was the biggest SSL I've ever seen, the big U-shape.
Yep. Yeah, the wraparound one.
Yeah.
And so he was in that room and the room next to it. And they were running 24 hours a day over there. And then as more and more people got involved in that session, they would take more and more studios. And they took Studio 2 and then Studio 1. And then they came down the street and took Studio D on the third floor.
I think we worked there with Nuno.
You worked there with Nuno? No, you worked in Studio C with Nuno.
Okay.
That's where you guys did some mixing.
That was the V.
The VR.
The VR Neve.
You worked in that room with Blondie. You guys
Right.
Blondie in studio. There was that big, long SSL.
Oh, that was a beautiful room, too.
And that was Teddy Riley. They brought Teddy Riley in to work. And I was put on that session, and I worked the night shift because I had the less seniority.
Yeah.
And so I worked 9 at night to 9 in the morning every day.
And did you ever run into Michael? Of course, you must have.
A few times.
What was that like?
It was incredible. Yeah. I mean, very humble person, always polite, very nice. I remember one time I'm trying to like not, you know, you're an assistant. Those were my assistant days, right, before I started engineering. You know, your job is to be kind of seen, not heard. And Michael was like listening to a playback or something, and he started dancing. And... you know, me and you right now, we're less than 8 feet away from each other, right? Yeah. And these guitars right in front of me, maybe 4 feet. That's how close he was to me. And he did every single move that you can imagine Michael Jackson doing. And I'm just like, you know what? I'm just going to watch. Like, how could you not, right? And, you know, the budget was just endless.
Right.
And, you know, people would come into at least Teddy's session and just order food.
I remember it was like kind of open menu season.
It was banana. Like at one point we spent $10,000, I think, something ridiculous on a monthly. It was all cash. And Eddie, the owner, came to us and was like, there's too much cash in the building. I'm giving you guys each a credit card. And at the end of the month, if the receipts don't equal out, you guys, it comes out of your pay.
Wow.
So I became an accountant very quickly. But look, it was great. I mean, it was a very, as a camaraderie back then, and all those people that had come in from California to work on that, and all of us assistants that were on it, it was
like
crazy.
It was like a family.
It was a lot of work.
The hours that you guys kept.
Those hours, I mean, I did 12 hours every day for 3 months straight with no days off.
Yeah.
You know, life did not go on.
Yeah.
I don't care about holidays. It wasn't about birthdays. It wasn't about anything. You worked. You know, even after that, when we were doing like regular sessions, I carried a backpack to work, and my backpack had a change of clothes, toiletries, and an umbrella.
Yeah.
Because I never knew where I'd be sleeping that night. And if I sat to stay at the studio because I had to be back too early, I would just sleep on the couch with a packing blanket and go down to the gym in the morning, shower, and do it again.
Wow.
Nights, too.
Yeah.
Mostly. Well, you'd start at 10. First downbeat was always 9 or 10, right?
Yeah.
And then typically, if you were doing like a tracking date, you know, you might finish around 6 or 7. And a lot of those weren't lockouts. Those were just kind of like the morning session, right?
Yeah.
And then it would change over, and if they didn't have someone, they would ask you if you'd stay.
Yeah.
I just never said no. And yeah, I'll stay.
That's why you got all that work, because you never...
I'll stay, sure.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You were always like that from day one.
I like to work, you know what I mean? I have no problem.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm getting a little older.
Yeah.
And I'm noticing that... I don't say I'm slowing down.
No, but it's different. I get it.
But, you know, the other day I was like, kind of like bumming out, like, man, I can only do this 6-hour session and I'm starting to get tired. And then I realized I had just come from 8 hours at the university, Webster University, where I teach and run the audio program.
Yeah.
I had just done 8 hours there and I did sex at night. And then I'm like, oh shit, no, this isn't 6 hours. This is
14.
Six on top of the eight. Yeah. Like, yeah, so I can still pull a couple hours.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, back in the New York days, I taught myself how to sleep anywhere. I would duck into the machine room and take a power nap for 5-10 minutes. And you'd be amazed what a power nap can
do. Oh, yeah. It saves me. It helps you reset your focus, too.
And you also have to learn about your body.
Yeah.
Like how your body reacts to caffeine, how your body reacts to nicotine, how your body reacts to water.
Yeah.
To juice.
I've had to slow down on the caffeine because I was, you know, espresso just became a little bit too much.
Well, I noticed my body would spike and then it would drop really hard.
Yeah.
So if I'm doing like a really long 1 or 2 day binge.
Yeah.
When I say binge, it's not with cocaine, it's with studio.
Yeah.
I stop the caffeine at some point and it's just water and fruit or juice.
Yeah. And it helps you keep going.
When I did all those years with Nelly, we would do... Sometimes the most we ever did was we went into a third day. So straight, you know, 2 days straight was a lot. That was such an occurrence that I can't even count how many times we did it.
And that was his whole crew. He had quite a crew. Tell us about your association with Nelly and how that turned into like a really major thing in your life.
Oh yeah. So it was a certain point in Hit Factory. I kind of went on independent, right?
Yeah.
On my own. And as a, at then, it was just an independent engineer, right?
Yep.
Mixer. And I was very fortunate throughout my whole career that there would be certain people would like lock on to me. At one point, there was a guy at Warner Brothers. I did a couple years with him doing all his records. And then, excuse me, I met a guy named Kevin Law out of Universal Records. And I just met him just in the Hit Factory, just in the hallway. We had a lot in common. We just shoot the shit. And one day... He asked me to do something, and I couldn't do it. It was what became Nellyville. He asked me if I wanted to go and, you know, make that record with them down in Florida. And I said, I can't. He's like, well, why? I go, well, I just signed a thing with Nuno to do what became Population One. I was going to California to make that record with him. He was like, well, blow him off. He's nobody. Like, come work with him. This is Nelly. You know, Nelly was riding high off of Country Grammar, like the biggest superstar in the world, right?
Yeah.
Or becoming one of them. And I'm like, dude, what would you say if the shoe was on the other foot? You know, what if I was blowing you off for something bigger than you? He's like, I might be pissed. I'm like, well, this is how I act. And so I went and did that record with Nuno, and I came back, and Kevin had this record of this pop girl from London named Sona Royale, I believe. And he wanted me to do it because it was a combination of live music and program music. And I'm very good at
both
worlds, right? Yeah. And the integration of them, how to sync machines up and how to, you know, manipulate and edit. And at that point, I became very versed in Pro Tools.
Yep.
I had seen the writing on the wall very early on and jumped on the ship so hard that I was getting hired as just a Pro Tools operator for a long time. You know, I shouldn't say a long time, but a good time in New York.
Yeah.
And so Kevin hired me for that record. And then he asked me if I want to do this record for a guy named Murphy Lee, which was one of the Lunatics.
Okay.
And we went to Atlanta and recorded. Fun fact is the last day of recording, we were down there for 2 weeks, did all the vocals for the record. And like you said, back then they all traveled together.
Yep.
All the Lunatics went. So it was like five Lunatics. Each Lunatic had an assistant. Each Lunatic had like a bodyguard. Each Lunatic had a bunch of friends.
Yeah.
And we were working at Stankonia down there. I don't know if you ever worked in
it. Oh, I worked there.
And it's a huge control room.
Yeah.
And it's people everywhere. The live room, they're doing tattoos and who's doing what. And I had everybody just in the booth doing vocals. So it was just a shenanigans. And I really enjoyed this crew. Like, everybody was really down to earth and really cool. And on the last day, Kevin was sick, the A&R guy. And he's like, I'm going back to the hotel. Because he knew we were going to be there all night.
Yeah.
And he goes, I'll swoop back in the morning, grab you, and then we'll go to the airport. We had like an early flight.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, no problem. And as he's leaving, he goes, no CDs. I go, what? He goes, yeah, no one gets a CD. Okay, cool. No worries. At the end of the morning shift, I'm cleaning up. I'm backing up my hard drives. And out of the corner of my eye, Nelly's walking towards me with Murphy Lee and Ali. And they're all, you know, Ali was the president of Dirty and a Lunatic. And Nelly is obviously Nelly, and Murphy Lee's the artist. And Nelly looks at me and goes, I need a CD. Murph needs a CD. Ali needs a CD. And I look up and I go, I'm sorry, no CDs. And Anthony, you could hear a pin drop. It was like the record scratches.
Yeah.
People were getting up, grabbing their shit and being like, oh, this dude's dead. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Before Kevin left, he said, no CDs. And they were like, I'm fucking Nelly. This is Murphy Lee, the artist. And he's the president of the record company. We want CDs. I'm saying, Universal said no CDs. I can't give you CDs. I just met everybody. Well, I'd met him before, but like this is the first time we really worked together.
Yeah.
And
company man.
Pissed. Grabs his phone, calls Kevin, and I can hear him on the line. Yeah. He pans me the phone and Kevin's like, yeah, they can have CDs. I'm like, you motherfucker. But fast forward when I'm working with Nelly full time, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours. And an artist who we're doing a feature with would turn to him and be like, hey, can I get a CD? For anybody who doesn't know, a CD is like this round thing you put in this machine and it plays music. It's not on your phone. And he would, without a beat, without dropping a beat, he'd be like, yeah, of course you can have a CD. Go ask Carl. Because he knew the first thing I'm going to say is, I'm sorry, no CDs. Like, it didn't bother me. Like, yeah. I would toe the company line, and he didn't have to look like the bad guy.
Yeah.
But he also knew deep down inside that I would never bootleg anything, that I would never leak anything, that I would never, you know, play shit for other people, right?
Well, that kind of trust is important, and that's probably one of the loyalties is the factor that probably kept you around him for...
Oh, my God. Yeah. Like, think about when, you know, unfortunately, when Prince passed away, we talked about his vault. You know? There are a few copies of Nelly's vault out there, you know, locked away in certain safes and stuff. And I had access to one of those for a very long time.
Yeah.
And there was never a leak on my watch, ever.
Yeah. Wow.
Which is pretty impressive, right?
It's hard because, I mean, you know, so many of these things started happening, you know, where these albums would just show up like on Napster or whatever, like, you know, and then they had the dat in the hat, you know, with all the live things, and like, and then movies like started getting bootlegged the same way in China, and like they're out before they're in the theaters. You know, that's really a tough area.
I remember back in the day when they'd have the camera in the theater showing the movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you asked me how I get to Nelly, and I kind of blew that answer.
Let's rewind a little bit.
Did that record.
Yeah.
Then they came back and they did a remix record of all his hits. We did that at the Hit Factory. We set up two studios. One, the regular studio where this guy was mixing all the records, this guy named Rich Travali.
Yep.
And during the night, I'd be tracking the remixes of all his pop songs, right? And I set up my Pro Tools rig in the live room and used the booth with a couple of cables going into it for vocals, right? And so we had this little factory going day and night.
Yep.
Did that. And then I got a phone call. It was going into Christmas time, and hey, you want to come to LA with us to make what is going to become the next Nelly record? Like, of course I want to come. And we moved out there, and we kicked around for a while. We went to almost every studio to find out which one he wanted to work at, right? The Village, Namus Studio, we went there. Sunset Sound, I mean, Sunset Marquee, like everywhere. We went to like producers' houses, and he could not catch a vibe. And all the while we were working at the Village, like doing the song, just getting, starting, right? I had him singing on, remember the Lawson, the gold Lawson L40, what was it, L47 or something?
Yeah.
Do you remember that mic we had for a long time?
Yeah.
So I was using that out there, and he sounded great on that, by the way.
That Lawson, the gold one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the one I traded Nuno for something for that.
He used to make those next door to East Iris. The studios in Nashville, like he was like next door making those.
That was a beautiful mic. I got it from Nuno on a trade, and I ended up, the capsule died on me years later. I had to get a new capsule, and then I ended up selling it or trading it for something. And to this day, I wasn't using it, but I regret getting. You know how it is. Like I'm looking around here, like you don't get rid of anything like I do, and the things I do get rid of, I miss the most.
Yeah, that's happened to me. Like there's been over the years stuff I've regretted. But
we couldn't find a studio.
Yeah.
And so
in LA,
that vibed with him.
Yeah. Wow.
He was looking for something very special because there was gonna be a lot of writing.
Yeah.
The record wasn't completely written. And before I went out there, I kind of figured something was gonna go on. So I did a quick little a budget on what would it cost to build a studio. Meaning not build a studio, but buy the equipment, speakers, microphone, Pro Tools, computer. It was like 40 or 50 grand. And while we're talking, I said, why don't we just get a house? And they're like, what do you mean? We can't do this in a house. I go, well, honestly, all the stuff I've been doing lately, I've been doing in houses. I've been doing in bars and barns, and I've been doing it in office buildings. And I bring my Pro Tools rig in and set up and, lay the cables down and record. And you can't tell, because I know what it's supposed to sound like in the big room.
Yeah.
So I can go to a little house and make it sound great. And they're like, are you sure? And I said, no, by the way, this is the price. And I said, when we're done, I can bring it to your house in Missouri and set it up and you'll have a studio in your house. And that was the
plan.
That was the plan. And then we went from looking at studios to houses. So think of two black SUVs pulling up in front of a mansion in Bel Air or Beverly Hills or the hills.
Yeah.
And all these people jump out and to look at this house, 14, 15, $20 million homes. And we settled on one right up from the Whiskey Go-Go. And there was like a master suite. So his bedroom was over here. There was a sitting room and a closet. We put all of Nelly's clothes in the closet, put the mic right in the middle, set up the sitting room. This was before you could buy like acoustic panels. You get some foam. I went to Home Depot, bought some packing blankets.
Yeah,
staple them to the wall with nails. Say staple. We didn't get our deposit back. And then bought some curtains and put it over. Like, it looked really nice, but it was taking first reflections away.
Yeah.
And we made what became Sweat and Suit. And if anybody doesn't know, Sweat and Suit was released as, wasn't a dual album. It was two single albums released on the same day. And we went number one and number two in Billboard.
Wow.
Second time in history, first time in history was Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. So that was a huge feat, and it was recorded in a house.
Wow, that was the
features were recorded at the record plant. So like if Snoop was recording, we'd go down to the record plant. Tim McGraw was recording, went down to the record plant. Christina Aguilera down to the record plant. he felt too embarrassed. Like, he was like, I don't want people coming to my house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was an incredible 3-4 month experience. I had so many frequent flyers, Miles. That record was unbelievable.
So you're going back and forth from...
For the first 3 months, we worked 3 months straight, 2 days off.
Yeah.
And I'm in L.A. I knew some people out here. I didn't even have time to go see. I like literally had 2 days off in 3 months.
Wow.
We worked every single day.
Wow. I'm going to go back and listen to that record now.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And it was mixed in New York.
Yeah. At the Hidden Factory?
No, that was mixed at Platinum
okay.
Island.
Okay.
Rich and Kevin were there mixing while we were finishing up the tracking. We finished New York, L.A., came back and forth a whole bunch of times. And then I went to Missouri and started going to his houses. First, we set up a house in his big house in Eureka, set up a studio there. And I don't know this about Missouri at the time, but there's a certain part of the year in the country where the frogs are very loud.
Oh, wow.
And we could not record. That's how loud they were. You know what I mean?
So how many months or what's the frog season? What does it run from what to what?
You know, I don't know because I bailed on that house pretty quickly and we moved to his lake house.
Oh, nice.
In Lake St. Louis. And they were building something already down there. This guy named Joe Zimmerman who does all the construction.
Yeah.
And we instantly moved in there and I pulled him aside and was like, you know, I'm tired of living in hotels. Can I just stay at this house? Because he didn't live in this house. This was like...
Yeah.
There was the Cribs house.
Oh, wow.
He did an episode for Cribs, and the next day, there was, people walking up to the house and bringing their boats up to there, and it was just, he couldn't live there. And so he moved me into one of the rooms upstairs, and we finished that album there. We finished The Longest Yard there. We finished a Murphy Lee... we started a Murphy Lee solo record that like a lot of records were done in that studio. And then we moved to the corporate offices. We built proper studios in there and then did so much more there.
Wow. It's just an incredible amount of work. I mean, it's just mind boggling. You know, I feel like we're just kind of scratching the surface here. We're going to do a double episode. So it's been great to have you this and we'll do another episode. We'll get you one next week too.
Yeah. I'd love to come back.
Awesome, man.
Yeah.
I love you, man.
I appreciate it. You too.
Anthony J. Resta, Studio Secrets, A to Z, signing off. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you, Anthony.